Hello and welcome to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. My name is Craig Barker and I'm the head of public engagement at the museum at the University of Sydney. Now, normally each episode of this podcast I have a guest on to discuss a particular object or a series of objects from the museum collection, but this episode is a little different. In this episode, the museum itself, or rather the concept of a museum, is the object under discussion. The 18th of May was International Museums Day. It also happened to coincide with the six-month anniversary of the opening of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. International Museum Day is an annual event organised by ICOM, the International Council of Museums, one of the peak international bodies in the GLAM sector. And GLAM, of course, represents galleries, libraries, archives and museums. Since 1977, International Museum Day has aimed to raise awareness of the role of museums in society. And in 2021, the theme was the future of museums, recovery and reimagine. To mark International Museum Day, we held a public panel discussion with four academics from the University of Sydney who work in and work with the GLAM sector, and all are involved in the University of Sydney's Museum Studies program. They discussed the future of museums with me. So for this very special episode of Object Matters, we've recorded the panel discussion. Please welcome our guests, Dr. Alex Birchmore, Dr. Anna Lawrenson, Dr. Helena Robinson, and Dr. James Flexner. Okay. All right, let's get started. A big warm welcome to the Chow Chak Wing Museum to our esteemed guests. Thank you for joining us this afternoon on what is International Museum Day 2021. Before I kick off the proceedings, I'd firstly like to begin by acknowledging that the Chow Chak Wing Museum and the University of Sydney is on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The Chow Chak Wing Museum and the University more broadly pays our respect and recognises the traditional owners of these lands that we meet on today, and we pay our respect to elders past, present and emerging. It's a great privilege to welcome you all today. My name's Craig Barker. I am the head of public engagement for the museum. And this panel's actually come together relatively quickly, so I'd like to firstly begin by thanking everyone for finding time in their very busy schedules to join us. But as many people in the room will know, that since 1977, ICOM has organised the International Museum Day, an annual celebration and marking of what museums mean to us and a means of the international museum community actually reflecting and talking amongst itself. So we thought that the panel discussion, particularly this year, as you'll see from the poster behind me, themed on the concept of the future of museums, recover and reimagine, we thought that it would be a good opportunity to actually talk to some of the experts from the University of Sydney involved in museum and heritage management and art curation programs here on the campus, to actually stop and think about that question and talk a bit more broadly. It's been a big period of reflection, I suspect, for all of us individually, but also the university community, given what's happened with COVID and the fact that we've opened this new institution so recently as well. So I'm going to begin by introducing very briefly our panellists today, and then I'm going to ask each of the panellists to just talk a little bit about their respective research, and then I've got a series of questions that I'll ask our four guests this afternoon. So firstly, and the most recent to join us here at the University of Sydney, is Dr. Alex Birchmore, an art historian and arts writer specialising in the study of Chinese and Southeast Asian art in the past and present, with a particular focus on ceramics and associated trade. Alex has had a remarkable career, roles including curatorial and provincing research at the Art Gallery of South Australia, the National Gallery of Australia in Canberra, and has been involved with the publication of Art Monthly Australasia. So thank you, Alex. Sitting next to me is Dr. Anna Lawrenson, who has, you've just clocked over a decade, haven't you, at the University of Sydney, which is, it goes fast, doesn't it? But Anna's career spans critical museology and the applied practice of having worked in both the arts industry and now in academia. Anna is particularly interested in funding, history and administration of public museums and galleries and the influence that their public offer in terms of brands, exhibitions and programming. On my other side, Dr. Helena Robinson was a museum studies researcher and lecturer, and many, many years teaching extensively within the Postgraduate Masters of Museums and Heritage Studies program. Since 2019, she has worked with the then newly created role under Deputy Vice Chancellor of Education here at the University of Sydney, teaching undergraduate industry and community project units, the ICPU, emphasising interdisciplinary complex problem solving and bringing that wealth of experience from the GLAM sector to the educational aspect. And then last but not least, Dr. James Flexner is a lecturer in historical archaeology and heritage studies here at the university. His main research interests are in landscape archaeology and historical archaeology, particularly with a focus on Vanuatu and other regions of the South Pacific, and someone who I have called on far too much to do public appearances on the radio in the past as well. So thank you for that too, James. So thank you all for joining us. Can I ask one at a time for you just to talk a little bit about your specific areas of research and how they might pertain to this broader question of the role of museums in the future? Alex.
So my specific area of research, as Craig mentioned, is Chinese art and Southeast Asian art. But I'm currently working, or I have a book in development at the moment where I look a bit about, mostly about museums in China and concepts of heritage tourism in China associated with ceramics and with the history of ceramics and the history of trade. And I've been thinking a lot about the future of museums, I guess, over the last year. With my work at Art Monthly Australasia, I wrote quite a few reflective pieces over the year where I thought a bit about how museums were adapting to some of the changes of that year and some of the difficulties and challenges. And that's something I'd like to pursue further. And hopefully out of the conversation from today, I can come up with some more ideas and things like that. But yeah, I don't want to take up too much time. So I'll pass over to Anna.
Thank you, Alex. And thanks, Craig, for inviting us. As Craig introduced, the dinosaur who's been here forever. I've sort of worked in the sector and in higher education, and that has really informed my areas of research, which are thinking about the kind of higher questions around the role and function of museums, but with really practical questions in mind, like what do the way that we structure our organisations in terms of their business models mean? What does that mean for how we can actually engage with the public? What role are we playing? Is it entertainment? Is it education? Is it actually, and I think this is what I've been thinking about in the last year, what is the role of well-being and what are the roles of our institutions as civic places for gathering and, really addressing some of those higher questions around our society and how it functions? And I think they've all really come to the fore in the last year. One of the projects I'm working on with the Peabody Museums and Galleries New South Wales is called Museums as Sites of Civil Society, in which we're addressing some of those questions, but part of the methodology of that is actually to go out and survey a lot of the institutions, particularly in New South Wales, because that's M&G's remit, to look at how they've coped not just with COVID but also with the fires and all of the kind of systemic challenges around funding that have really, for many institutions eroded what they're able to offer in recent times. So that's kind of my big picture of where my research lies. And it's fascinating. And it's also fabulous, I have to say at the start, to see so many of our graduates here because you are the future of museums. So it's really nice to see that being carried forward as well.
Helena.
Thanks, Anna. So I, in a way, come from a similar background to Anna. I started out as an undergraduate studying art history. Then I moved on to a Master of Museum Studies, as it was called in those days, before sort of spending around 15 years working in the museums and galleries sector and simultaneously also then doing my PhD research in museum studies as well. So I also share that kind of practical a ground-level interest in how museums operate, and specifically I'm very interested in how we create meaning around objects within museums. So if objects don't speak directly to us and divulge their meaning to us? How is it that we come to certain ideas about why objects are significant, why collections mean what we think they mean, and why we hold them in such high regard? And I look at that, I love looking at that from an organisational level. So I look at the museum in my research as essentially a complex system that is brought about it's kind of a network, or it exists at the intersection of a range of different actors and a range of different influences, which include public policy, which include funding, which include the different disciplines that come together and work together in a museum, that include the collections themselves and the kind of affective properties that objects have. And through that kind of cross-pollination and interaction, that these meanings really come to life. So I like looking at how that happens. I think that's very interesting. I've also looked in my research at how the collecting professions themselves differ, where their similarities and where their contrasts lie. So what are the kind of differences and similarities between library, archival, and museum practices? And I'm also very interested in the idea of how museums interact with external stakeholders. The concept of participation has become a key idea within contemporary museology. But again, looking at how we ascribe meaning to objects, what is the actual role that people outside of the museum actually play in contributing to understanding object meanings? So that's a kind of a broad inquiry. And what I think I'm most interested in, I guess, is the idea of interpretive sustainability. So making the museum a site where we can have an ongoing productive exchange of different viewpoints.
So I probably come to the museum from actually a slightly different perspective than particularly Anna and Helena, in that my interests really lie in the research value of collections. So people often talk about, maybe complain about the fact that, you know, museums display maybe 2-5%, if you're lucky, of their collections for the public. And a lot of my work in the museum space has been about really understanding the research value of all of that 95%+ of other stuff that sits there in the storeroom to help us learn about cultural histories and cultural evolution, particularly for the kinds of Pacific Islander societies that I'm interested in and who I work with. And then on the other side of that, as someone who works on the ground with various kinds of indigenous communities overseas in places like Vanuatu, but also here in Australia, thinking about questions about repatriation, not only of ancestral remains, although that's obviously an urgent matter for the 21st century, but also thinking about how to make objects that sit in museum stores more relevant and more available to people, particularly in a country like this one, where the majority of cultural institutions sit in a few capital cities, and the rest of that, you know, material that comes from everywhere else that's out there can be hundreds or thousands of kilometers away. So how to really try to bridge that in the present, I think, is a really important question for us to grapple with and think about in terms of both the practical implications, but also the theoretical implications of you know, thinking about how do we make these things meaningful for people, and why might they be meaningful for people.
Thank you all, and I think that's actually quite a good point too, James, because we are going to cover repatriation, or at least touch upon repatriation this afternoon, and relationships with Indigenous and other communities and the ways that museums can go forward. But before we get there, one thing I want to start with in terms of questions, and I'm going to start with you, Helena, because I know that you have recently written a paper on this particular issue as well. But the fact that International Museum Day, of course, is a day under the auspices of ICOM, but as many people in the GLAM sector will be aware, but others are perhaps not aware, that ICOM as an organisation has been grasping and struggling over the past 3 or 4 years now with the actual definition of what a museum is. Could you give us a little bit of background on that,
broader debate, but I guess the broader question for all of us is, how can we celebrate International Museums Day when those of us in the sector can't even agree what a museum is?
Yes, so I wonder whether most of you are now going through in your own minds thinking, how would I actually define a museum? What is a museum? On the surface, it seems like such an obvious question, and some people argue, why do we even ask this question? Because it does seem so self-evident in certain respects. But I think for ICOM, it has been... So ICOM is the International Council of Museums and it's affiliated with UNESCO. And so it acts as one of the peak bodies for the international museum sector. And they've really been struggling with the idea of does the current ICOM museum definition, which has... I think the last time it was kind of formally ratified was in 2007, but it has remained relatively unchanged since around the 1970s, with the same sort of key components. And they've been really struggling with, you know, does it need to be rethought? Now, I have actually brought with me, because I can't remember it off by heart... both the old definition, and then I will read out also the proposed new definition, because I think what this tells us is that museums are very much in this state of flux, that we do feel that museums are being called upon to do more, definitely an environment where they do not have more resources at their disposal in order to do that wider range of tasks, which now come into areas such as well-being, such as supporting different demographics. They're being called upon to contribute to a scholar called Clive Gray talks about this as policy attachment. So museums becoming called upon to sort of deliver on, you know, economic policy, tourism, health, all these other areas, but we don't have more resources to do that. And also asking ourselves ethical questions, which I think James touched on a little bit too, around the legacies of collecting, in the what has ended up in our collections and how, being a constant sort of thorn in our side these days in the sector, and wondering how we position ourselves in relation to that. So just to give you a very, very, very brief background on this, ICOM started to debate the museum definition as it currently stands or stood in about 2017, and they decided that it did need to be rewritten. Now, the definition at that point and currently as it still stands reads, "The museum is a non-profit, permanent institution in the service of society and its development, open to the public, which acquires, conserves, researches, communicates, and exhibits the tangible and intangible heritage of humanity and its environment for the purposes of education, study, and enjoyment." Okay, so it's a fairly comprehensive definition. It's 45 words, in case you're wondering. this is relevant because the proposed definition that ICOM put forward at their 2019 general conference was 99 words long, and it caused a huge amount of debate. It was actually voted down in the end. They could not vote on this despite extensive consultation. Should I read the 99 word version?
I think we have time.
Okay. All right. "Museums are democratizing, inclusive, and polyphonic spaces for critical dialogue about the pasts and the futures. Acknowledging and addressing the conflicts and challenges of the present, they hold artifacts and specimens in trust for society, safeguard diverse memories for future generations, and guarantee equal rights and equal access to heritage for all people. Museums are not for profit. They are participatory and transparent and work in active partnership with and for diverse communities to collect, preserve, research, interpret, exhibit, and enhance understandings of the world, aiming to contribute to human dignity and social justice, global equity, and planetary well-being." Okay, I'm going to hand over the microphone to someone else for maybe a brief comment on that definition.
Well, I think the first thing is we all need much bigger budgets to achieve a fraction of those aims. But would any of the other panelists like to make any comments about that or the broader concept of defining?
I think, you know, to me what's very clear is that that's an aspirational definition rather than a definition of anything that any museum even comes close to achieving in the present. And particularly, I forgot the exact language, but something about how, you know, museums are kind of equally accessible to all and equally, you know, available to all people is like, we know that's not true. We know there's all kinds of barriers that actually keep people out of museums for a whole variety of reasons. And I think that among many other things is going to be one of the major challenges for these kinds of institutions as the century goes ahead is, you know, if that's an ideal that we want to strive for, great. But in terms of actually achieving that, there's all kinds of sort of mechanisms in the way that prevent that happening, most of which actually sit outside of the museum, which I think is one of, you know, it's sort of, these places are not accessible in spite of what curators want and what interpreters want and what researchers want.
I'd add to that. I think it's really fascinating. I agree, it's an aspirational definition. To me, it embodies the ideology of the new museology that, you know, we think about was 1989, the Virgo book, and yet we're still not there. We're still needing to put forward this definition, which is explicitly trying to push constituents and think about ICOM as a member organisation, which is trying to push constituents in a particular direction. So I think it's interesting to look at the gap, if you like, between what we aspire to be and what actually happens on the ground, but to then add into the mix what our funders aspire for us, you know, and that the kind of social justice and the well-being in certain contexts is being very much pushed by government agendas, whereas in Australia we're probably not quite being pushed as strictly in that direction at the moment, but we're tied to, what was it, policy... Policy attachment. We're tied to different kind of policy objectives. So I think one of the fundamental things which is interesting about a definition of museums is that the institution is bound by the political and funding context in which it's operating. And so we can see that in certain contexts, those social justice imperatives are really strong, whereas there might be more of a, you know, destination marketing economic imperative in other contexts. And I think that's obviously the problem of ICOM is that it's having to provide this umbrella under which everything sits when... If we're arguing for diversity and polyphony and, you know, all of those kind of nice inclusive terms, then it becomes very difficult to homogenise our institutions into a single definition.
I agree with what James and Anna have said, but I also thought it was... It always strikes me with things like this that they talk about inclusivity and polyphony, but then the words that are used are sometimes not the most... inclusive words. I mean, a lot of people, that would be complete nonsense to a lot of people. And to me, that sort of builds an image of the museum as an elitist institution to a certain extent. And it becomes quite an unattainable, and it sort of distances it even more from what they're trying to achieve in a way when you start talking about polyphony and pasts and futures and I don't know. It's a very admirable effort. And another thing I thought was interesting was... that the public trust came back into it, which I thought was a good kind of direction to push it. And that idea of the public trust and holding things in the public trust and communicating them to the public. And I think maybe push more in that direction would be advisable on their part.
I've got a couple of things I'd like to add into the mix there. So you were mentioning that the idea of the public trust came back in. When I was looking at the two definitions and comparing them for Craig, you were very kind in saying I've got a new paper. It's actually not published. It's just in peer review, so it may still get rejected. But I was comparing these two definitions. So two of the terms that came out that don't appear in the new version, even though it's much longer, more than double the length, is education and entertainment or enjoyment. So I thought that, you know, it's interesting to look at what comes in but also what gets taken out and why that might be. The other thing is that I think all of you have identified that it is very much an aspirational statement, but it's also interesting to think about the purpose of a definition. A definition needs to convey what it is about a museum, that what are its core elements without which there would be no museum. And the ICOM definition is actually used in, picked up by governments, and it's referred to in legislation that relates to museums around the world. So you can think about something as mundane as maybe taxation law or something like that, where certain museums as not-for-profit institutions, as public institutions, might be subject to different kinds of taxation requirements as compared to a private institution, for example. So once governments start to adopt these definitions, well, what kind of institutions does a very long and all-encompassing definition, what does that start to exclude, just for the very reasons that all of you have brought up? Because, for example, in non-democratic countries, can museums be democratizing? Well, they can't be, probably. Does that mean they're not a museum? So all of these kinds of debates have come up.
Now, you mentioned before and that entire discussion about the definitions that the sector is in something of a state of flux, certainly philosophically, but one thing that we've seen over the last 12 months is that we've certainly been in a state of flux like every industry because of the COVID pandemic. At one end of the scale, you've got somewhere like the Louvre going from its annual 9 million visitors down to a mere 2.7 million. Poor them. But at the other end of the scale, at one stage, there were estimates that up to one-third of volunteer-run museums in the United States would close completely as a result of the COVID pandemic. Can any of you, and I'll start with you, Alex, because you did mention you've been thinking about this in terms of editing some of the papers for Oscillation Art Monthly, but can any of you reflect upon how the museum and gallery sector has seemingly responded to COVID, some of the things that we've done well, some of the things we've done badly, and how that might impact upon where we go over the next couple of years?
I mean, I guess the big thing that everyone talks about is the push towards digitization and digital programs. But what I found last year was that a lot of people saw that as a kind of isolated thing which arose in response to the pandemic, whereas I found that it just was enhanced and increased. It was a process that was already in train before the pandemic, and then the urgency to digitize collections and to increase digital access obviously grew when the doors were shut on the physical institutions. So that, I suppose, is the main thing that everyone talks about in terms of how museums responded to that issue of not being able to open their doors to their publics. But then I guess other ways in which they responded, I don't know. I mean, I'd like to think there was more of a push towards attracting new audiences to museums and perhaps attracting new forms of engagement with collections and new forms of thinking about collections and thinking about works of art and about museums in general, just because you couldn't, there wasn't an ability to rely on the usual ways of doing things, I suppose. What else did I encounter? One thing that I'm interested to see is how is crowd, in terms of practical things, is crowd management and just ideas of the blockbuster and how that's going to fare in a world in which we can't really have large numbers of people packing into small spaces. And I think to a certain extent, we won't really see that model anymore, or we'll have these very timed experiences and small groups. And I think it will probably transform in some ways how people engage with museums in terms of moving through in small groups and in very narrow time windows. It turns it into a ticketed experience to a greater extent than it was.
Ironically, undermining the concept of democratizing the experience as well, too, doesn't it? If you have timed entrance, that really does impede access for a large proportion of our potential audience members, doesn't it?
I'd guess I just wanted to add to that about the so I agree. I think the what was some of the lovely things I think that came out of COVID were institutions actually having to look inwards to their own collections, some really lovely both physical exhibitions but also online projects that looked inward and actually developed new research around collections where often there isn't space or time to do that. So I think they're a couple of the really were the nice things I saw about coming out of COVID. I think I'm really interested in, you know, obviously the business model of museums and galleries is about having people come through the door. You count all the people coming through the door, and that's what you measure your success based on. And obviously that business model is flawed when there's a pandemic. So there's on one level there's an opportunity to look for audiences outside of your normal context through the digital means. But on the other hand, I think there's actually a really great opportunity now to change the way that we kind of measure success in institutions and to think about a more meaningful engagement. Intimacy is one of the words that we've sort of seen debated around in post-COVID times, thinking about how visitors coming back into museums, maybe not so much in Australia, but certainly in countries much more affected than us, actually need a helping hand to come back in, actually really need a genuine kind of connection and engagement with the institution, which is not about, you know, here's your time ticket, you've got 15 minutes to get through the show. So I think there's a real opportunity to change that narrative, to say all the flaws in our system have all been highlighted through the pandemic. So let's actually think about what we can do better, and how can we enter into these more meaningful relationships that, you know, whilst they might be small scale, they might not be largely democratising, are actually about that more equal exchange and relationship with visitors, in which the visitor is kind of acknowledged and valued in that transaction. So I think that's something I'm really looking forward to seeing whether it actually develops.
It's been really interesting watching during the last kind of 12 or 16 months what's happened in Pacific Islands museums, where they've shifted from really being spaces that were largely for kind of international tourist consumption to figuring out, you know, what they're going to do when there are no tourists, right? The Pacific Islands bubble, or whatever you want to call it, has been kind of, I think, cast globally as this sort of success story of places where there were no cases or a few cases from overseas. And so people have just been out living their lives. So a country like Vanuatu, which really relied on international tourism for most of its economy, has suddenly had to rethink, you know, what are we about and why and who is all this stuff for? You see things like the Vanuatu Cultural Center running through the National Museum, a series of what they called custom school, this sort of place where young people could come and they could learn traditional stories, they could learn different forms of artwork, you know, sand drawing, basket making. They can engage with the collections in various ways. And it's really been a reframing of what these institutions do in I think a really interesting way that I hope, anyway, optimistically, once borders are open and tourism resumes in whatever form that's going to take, people actually start to think about, you know, how these things can actually be resources for community building and for intergenerational knowledge sharing in ways that maybe they weren't being used previously.
Obviously, COVID was the number one news story of 2020, but not far behind it was the Black Lives Matters movement. In many ways, the museum and gallery sector has been aware that this day of reckoning was coming for a long time. But it's interesting how a lot of the debate framed around understanding of the roles of slavery and so on within cultural institutions is being played out. We see at the moment a big debate in Britain where it's become quite political in terms of the way that their culture war is being played out that the museum and cultural sector has been very much brought to the centre of the discussion there. You've also got, and you touched upon it earlier, James, but issues of repatriation. I can think of, for example, Dan Hicks's book, The British Museum, and his argument for the repatriation of the Benin bronzes, both from the Pitt Rivers Museum collection where he's based, but also from other English cultural organisations. And interestingly, a number have followed through, such as the Church of England in recent weeks. But I'm guessing a broader question, and we'll probably have a few follow-up questions on this. But before I ask this too, I'm very conscious of the fact that we are five white people having this debate. So perhaps we are not the best people to have this debate. But at least in terms of raising the question, how can we make the sector more diverse? How can we better represent the communities whose items are within the collections? And can museums decolonise at all? Sorry, there's a lot there. We might break that down into smaller parts. I guess the question of representation might be a good place to start. What is the role of a museum and a gallery?
I'll start on a pessimistic note. Why not? but I think maybe we'll get somewhere better. I mean, I think it's clear evidence of how far we have to go is a story that probably didn't make a lot of waves here, but which was really prominent in, as you can probably tell from my accent, not from Australia originally, I'm from the US. There was a physical anthropology course being offered by Princeton, which was a Coursera, you know, for-profit massive online course, and the white, you know, progressive thinking, arguably, in her head, anthropologist who taught the course used as one of the case studies the remains of incinerated children whose homes were bombed by the City of Philadelphia Police Department in 1987. And this was just considered acceptable museum practice. The remains ended up in the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Anthropology. They moved with the anthropologists involved between these kind of elitist Ivy League institutions. And that's just sort of, that's where the practice of our discipline is in 2021. And, you know, there are black anthropologists, there are black biological anthropologists in North America, and people wonder why they continue to feel marginalized and traumatized by their own discipline. And I think, you know, as long as we've got that to deal with, we're still a long way from anything representing real kind of inclusivity and accessibility of our discipline for people from those kinds of marginalized communities.
I'll pick up on taking off from there. I agree, and I think, Helena, your definition of the 99 words still had in it something about trust, right? The public trusts museums. And to my mind, it seems that that's not a trusting relationship which is equal and kind of equitable and reciprocal. It is about seeing institutions as knowledge holders. And I still think that there is a great deal of reticence within perhaps some of our more established institutions to actually become more inclusive, to actually give over that trust. James, your example perfectly demonstrates that in a university context, but it wouldn't be hard to find it in a museum context either. So I think actually we need to think about the not just how we define museums going forward, but how much they're actually willing to change. And, you know, if we think about inviting visitors into a partnership, how can we make that a more equitable partnership where knowledge is shared? Because it seems to me that the main role that many museums see themselves playing is that of knowledge transmitter, knowledge holder. Interesting that education is not part of that 99-word definition, but I think it's still implicit in it.
Yeah, and just quickly, you know, museums are absolutely culpable in the example I gave. So it's the University of Pennsylvania Museum, where the curators are people like Bob Purcell and Lynn Meskel and people who've written lots of nice words about, you know, how to make museums more inclusive spaces, and then you look at what their institutions are actually doing in practice, and it's a completely different story. So there's clearly some kind of disconnect to be reconciled between what people think they're doing in these institutions and what's actually happening there.
And indeed, that revelation came hot on the heels of discussion and debate about the very considerable number of human remains of African American slaves held within the same institution as well. So it wasn't a one-off in that one particular institution, and I suspect that many, many others would have multiple cases, not just an individual one.
I wondered whether I would actually even weigh in on this question, because I think it is so complicated. Not in the sense of, I think the examples of that relate to human remains are, you know, that we don't really need to argue about those at all. I think there's, you know, I was quite shocked to hear your story. Actually, I hadn't heard of that, James. So, I guess it's a related point, and I'm interested to hear what my colleagues here think of this. But one thing I slightly worry about on a bigger picture, from a big picture perspective, is that museums are becoming very politicized. In some cases, you know, it's unavoidable, such as the ones that you've raised. In other cases, as a sector, I wonder whether we are doing a lot of navel-gazing at the expense of actually being genuinely responsive to the outside world and to our publics. As we all do, we get, you know, we get tens, if we're lucky, we only get tens of emails a day. So one of the things I get is a regular update from the American Association of Museums, the AAM, and they're about to run a very big conference where they're going to have 60 different sessions. And one of the great advantages of this, of course, is that you don't have to miss anything because everything will be recorded, so you can watch all 60 later on. I had a quick skim through the program, and almost, I would say, two-thirds, maybe more, of the sessions are about these sorts of questions. And I just wonder whether these sorts of questions are actually the questions that people who come to museums on a regular basis, or who don't come to museums actually, are asking, or whether that's what they want or expect when they come, if they were to come perhaps. I think that there is an issue around, it does come back to trust. There's, again, I've seen data from the US that doesn't relate necessarily to museums but relates to public institutions in general, and there has been a trend of declining trust in public institutions as seemingly the political polarization has grown, and the way that there's been a perception that public institutions have become caught up in a lot of the political arguments and have become kind of sites of, I don't want to exclude the need for political debate in museums. I just wonder whether we're overdoing the politics of museums to some degree, and whether there's a chance that we might alienate people as a result, and in fact lose the trust. And I think from my perspective, and it goes back to that definition, that new version of the definition, once we prescribe that we want our institutions, in order to qualify as museums, to be essentially social justice warriors, for lack of a better term, do we already then narrow down the range of interpretation that can happen in museums? Do we restrict the kinds of narratives that end up being told in museums? And do we lose trust because we are not inclusive of a diverse range of perspectives that can be productive in helping us solve these important societal problems? So that would be my question. I know that's not really a question either. It's like Craig. I copied Craig. I put too many things in the question, but I do think about this.
Yeah. Can I? I'll
I think we're already ostracising people, so there's no reason to say, well, let's not. I think if you look at it in terms of, well, we've got to keep our existing constituents happy, so we shouldn't engage in political debate. Our constituents are often the kind of mould that is entirely problematic. They're well-educated, affluent, you know, economically stable. That's the sort of demographic that museums and galleries attract more broadly. So I actually don't see it as a risk to not engage in those political debates.
Paradoxically, I think that's exactly the population that is interested in those debates. And I'm not sure that the others who we claim are, you know, that we're striving to kind of bring into the fold, I don't think we've asked them enough. I don't know. I don't think that I worry about the evidence base for some of this. I know it's controversial. I know I'm playing devil's advocate, but I do wonder about in this crowd. You know, we're already preaching to the converted in a sense. What would others? Would this pass the pub test? Is what I'm saying.
I mean, I've been thinking of a couple of different things as we've been talking. I mean, one is you're absolutely right, right? It's the sort of teaserly poor metaphor and probably, you know, tired stereotype. It's kind of like the gay marriage in Parramatta, you know, or in Western Sydney discussion from a few years ago, where it was sort of like, oh, look, these people in Western Sydney, you know, they didn't do the kind of good liberal things that the progressive people in the city, you know, thought they should do, basically. And so our museum's kind of propagating a version of that, where in fact, you know, the people who maybe aren't comfortable in these spaces don't want to feel like they're being preached to and told what to believe and told how to behave and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I wonder if there's an element of that, but I don't think that necessarily means that museums should be shying away from having these kinds of discussions. I actually think it is, if anything, a motivator to talk very explicitly about the politics of the spaces that we inhabit, and the collections that we hold and the meanings of those collections and their relevances to different groups of people. And, you know, I don't know. I personally, I don't mind having an argument. You know, I don't feel like everyone needs to be nice to each other all the time or agree with each other all the time just because you're in a museum and, you know, we're meant to be kind of quiet and reverential. Like how much more engaging could it be to actually have a conversation in a museum where things get kind of real? And I think what's interesting is, you know, in a sense, those of us who work with Indigenous communities, that is what's happening already, right? Like me as sort of a white guy who works with Black people, like you're kind of used to people telling you off occasionally and you have to be okay with it because in a sense, they're right. You know, in a sense, you're kind of standing with all of that historical weight of the institution behind you. And the people who don't see themselves represented in that institution are correct to kind of tell you off for it. And that's okay, because the place you're trying to get through via that sometimes very robust, shall we say, discussion is a place where actually you figure out how to work together and you find those places of kind of mutual understanding and mutual respect. And so I don't know, I kind of would go in the opposite direction and just kind of embrace that potential for fractiousness and difficulty in the conversations we're having, because I don't think we're going to get anywhere not kind of doing that during this moment.
Thinking is, I mean, my opinion is that everything is political, so it's kind of inescapable that politics is just part of every single action and thing that we do, and that especially institutions do. And I tend to feel it's a bit disingenuous if an institution tries to say that they don't want to be political, because it's sort of a political act to say that you're being apolitical. And I think that, and I agree that, you know, it's difficult not to talk for people, and I've had a lot of privilege. You know, I haven't had the most privileged background, I'm sure, living in a place like Sydney, but I've had a lot of privilege to get a university education and to be where I am now with a position in such a prestigious university. And I know I can't talk for certain people, but I do feel that there is a responsibility to recognize that those people have a view and a need to be kind of considered and heard, I suppose. And then if we can do what we can to try and bring new voices into the institution and try and create more inclusive displays, and I mean, I'm not sure of the mechanisms that we can use to do that because I haven't had the chance to think a lot about that. But I think that what's happening at the moment is a good, I guess, a reckoning or a kind of watershed moment. And I suppose it will get quite histrionic and quite extreme, and then it will probably settle into a pattern and will become more manageable as things go along. But I don't know if I agree there's a danger of museums becoming social justice institutions or social justice warriors or anything like that. But I can see what you mean. And I've had similar discussions with students in my classes as well.
So the reason that I came around to this thinking, and by the way, I don't want to create the impression that I'm anti anything political in museums. I think maybe what I'm saying is maybe not everything we have to do needs to be political. Whereas the new definition that we read out, it was stipulating that we did need to be political about almost everything that we do. The reason I came around to this line of slightly sort of, some doubts started creeping in is because, as Anna mentioned, the new museology was a kind of an ethos, a philosophy that took hold in the museums profession and in the scholarship around museums from around the late 1980s, but actually started with much earlier than that in the 60s and 70s with eco museums in Europe and in South America, which was a very much a grassroots movement to get museums, to get communities more involved and for communities to make their own museums, for example. And the new museology did have at its core that democratizing principle. And what it was actually responding to and against was the traditional mode of, that developed in the sort of 19th century museum, where the museum was seen as a social reformer. It was seen as a place that would have a civilizing effect and where people could learn how to interact with one another in an acceptable way. That would be part of a well-functioning, you know, the sort of the shaping and molding of people for what was thought by perhaps an elite as being a well-functioning society. But then I started to wonder whether we were not using the same mechanisms, even if the message was different, if we weren't starting to use the same mechanisms in thinking about how to almost work people around to a new way of thinking about issues like race or issues like inclusivity, whether there wasn't a certain orthodoxy coming back into museums that was in fact where museums had diverged and sort of through the initial thrust of the new museology come towards being this amazing spectrum of different viewpoints and functions and types of museums and the gorgeous sort of idiosyncrasy of museums, whether that wasn't going through a kind of convergence again where we were coming back towards this kind of standardized perception of what museums were for and that they would be for, they would be again performing a kind of social reforming function. And that's what's made me think more critically about this sort of question.
There's a lot in this current discussion we're having that I'd like to follow up on, particularly issues around repatriation as well, but I'm conscious that we are going to run out of time, and there's a few other matters I'd like us just to touch upon very quickly, so I think we might revisit this conversation in future. But one thing, certainly from the perspective of Australia, that there's been much discussion over the past couple of years, that with a few notable exceptions, and one very notable exception, budgets for Australian national cultural institutions and state institutions have been certainly reduced. You can make arguments about lines of measuring, but there's certainly been much less public money towards galleries, or the glam sector more generally, I should say. Would anyone like to make a comment in terms of how that may impact upon Australia's museums going forward?
Well, obviously, look, I like to think of things in terms of opportunities. So, we've got a diminishing... Thanks, Helena. We may have diminishing government funding, and we know that that is pushing institutions more toward revenue generation. Some of my students who are museum and gallery admin graduates are going, oh, here we go again. We know income generation then becomes key. Income generation and the percentage that we're able to attain is also liberating. It actually extricates us from some of these ties that bind us to government policy. Whether that actually then fundamentally changes the role of an institution, whether it's still in the service of society, which is a key element of the original or current ICOM definition, perhaps that is a question. But look, I do think that, as I said before, I like the idea of a watershed moment. I think we are at a watershed moment where we can change the narrative about the value of museums and galleries. And I think that establishing a relationship with our constituents that is more meaningful and individual gives us a good opportunity to build advocates out of broad society more generally, and perhaps those advocates vote with their feet and actually, you know, advocate for more funding for cultural institutions if we want to continue down this public funding model. Maybe that gets us out of the sort of political accountability. If we go down that public funding model, then we're still sort of in the political machinations. I was thinking about, in terms of the discussion we were just having, maybe it's more constructive to think not of museums and galleries as kind of innately political and that's a bad thing, but to think about how we might be more transparent. And, you know, coming back to this idea that museums are not neutral, you know, from the actual collections that you hold, you're making value judgments about what is worth collecting and what is not. The exhibitions that you put on are value judgments about what we should be interested in, what we should know about. So perhaps it's more constructive to think not how we can engage in political debates, but how we can actually say, look, this is what we're doing. We're being transparent about this. We're acknowledging that this is one story that could be told, but there are many other stories, and how might we include some of those other stories? So I think that was a sneaky way to get a comment in on the last discussion, but I do think there are opportunities in the diminishing funding context as well. And like, we're seeing lots of really interesting exhibitions, to come back to more practical stuff, that are developed with touring in mind, that are making really clever use of technology, new technology, to reduce some of those costs around freight, and to think about how we might be more environmentally sustainable in our practices as well. So yeah, I think there are exciting opportunities, but it's also very hard on a day-to-day basis, obviously.
So I think I'm probably not so optimistic about how a step away from public funding represents an opportunity, because what fills that vacuum is, you know, okay, so you're not getting as much money from the state. Who do you go to? You go to Rio Tinto, or you go to, you know, some other company that makes its money through some unethical means, and they're sort of there to fill in that gap. Or, and I think this is equally kind of a problem, you know, I say, as we sit in this lovely building built, you know, by essentially private funding from a certain well-known Chinese Australian billionaire, it's almost going back to that old, like, 17th and 18th century patronage model, in this way that we live in this kind of weird 21st century plutocracy, where a few people actually have the means to support these kinds of cultural institutions. Again, I mean, how do you build democratic spaces and somewhere where only a very small number of people and institutions actually have the means to make these things possible and make them sustainable. I don't see that as necessarily the model that we want to follow, where we go back to basically the Medici family deciding, or the 21st century equivalents of the Medici family deciding kind of what we do and how we do it.
I agree. I think that's where transparency needs to be key. Yes, I was being very optimistic. There are obviously a whole swathe of issues associated with how you generate funds, but I do think that there is an importance in that notion of transparency, but also changing the way that we try and demonstrate value to society, because I think that's actually the crux of the problem.
I'll just add something there. So I think we're thinking about this as a top-down issue to some degree. What can we do to better manage the money that is there, or what can we do to make ourselves seem more accessible and more worthwhile and worth the investment? But I wonder whether there isn't an element of this where it's there's an element of it that's not up to museums. I think we, as individuals, I think we need to value our own cultural background, our own cultural artifacts that we live with every day. I'm just thinking that, you know, yes, there are millions of objects in museums, but there are so many more objects in private hands, in our own homes, everywhere. And we can be more, I think if people are more, become more appreciative and more interested and engaged with their own heritage, then hopefully some of that could flow through to interest in museums as kind of higher up the food chain, sort of aggregators of that perhaps. But I think if it doesn't exist at grassroots level, I don't know what sustainability looks like in the long term. I don't think you can push it from just top down, but I also don't know what the answer to that is.
Thinking more about that top-down grassroots duality, one thing that I think doesn't get mentioned enough is the fact that the budget cuts sort of primarily influence small and medium arts organizations and museums, and they can't attract large funders because they're not interested to support small or emerging institutions and organizations. And having worked for Arts Monthly Australasia, which was one of many, I know it's kind of tangential to museums, but one of many arts publications which was completely stripped of any government funding, and just being the publication manager and struggling to find alternative sources that you could actually use to fund that. And it's just, I think that's the largest tragedy in terms of the lack of government funding, is there's just nothing to fill the void, and then things just inevitably can't continue, which is quite sad, in my opinion.
Now, we have actually used up our allocated hour, and I've still got two questions for the panel. So if you will indulge me, but of course, if people have other commitments, you are most welcome to head on through. But I might ask everyone for very short answers for these next two questions. no pressure. But all four of you are, of course, involved in education and training the next generation of museum practitioners and GLAM sector workers. What do you see their challenges will be that weren't necessarily challenges for our generations or previous generations?
A lot of my students are actually of my generation. So, I mean, the main challenge is just finding work, really, or finding something to do after university, which is probably the grimmest challenge, which we tend to try to avoid, or I try to avoid, because it's just difficult to think of a solution, really. But I guess, yeah, I don't know. That would be the main thing I would.
Sorry, very pessimistic.
I'll be the happy clappy then. Again, look, I agree. It's a challenging kind of landscape to get out and think about how you're going to approach your career. But I do think there's enormous opportunity for people who are coming up through the ranks who see things differently, who have that different perspective, who've seen, you know, in the 10 years that I've been teaching ethics, to see all of those Benin bronzes being returned this year is just astounding. And for somebody coming up through the ranks now for whom that is the norm, that we are actually in a position to make substantial changes to our cultural institutions, I think that's an enormous opportunity, and I see a really optimistic future.
So I'm going to look beyond museums, galleries and cultural institutions, maybe not beyond cultural institutions, but I would say that people who are studying in museums and heritage studies perhaps, they already have a disciplinary ground, you know, they have that foundation. They gain a lot of really interesting and valuable knowledge and skills through, you know, through museum studies and heritage studies. And I think one way to sort of maximize opportunity is to think about those skills as transferable. So how are those skills applicable in other contexts beyond the narrow framework of what you might think of? You know, you can work somewhere else other than an art gallery or a museum or an auction house. There are other places you can apply those skills, your communication skills, your digital skills, your understanding of organizational dynamics. And so I think if our students were, you know, think more broadly about how they can apply those skills, I think, and our students do, our graduates do find that. So I think that's one way to just broaden your horizons.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one of the grand challenges, and this probably goes for people working in any field, but in particularly in our sector, I think the ability to cause trouble is probably something that people are going to struggle with in a situation where you know, opportunities are very limited. There's a lot of competition. There's a lot of people who want to work in the sector, probably more people who want to work in the sector than the positions that exist. Your ability to take a stand is, you know, can be, look, it can be scary to do it, right? It's a risk to tell people who are maybe in a position to decide whether you continue to be employed or not, or whether you get employed in the first place or not, something they don't want to hear. And so I think that's where, you know, things like a very kind of grounded understanding of ethics and an understanding of your own politics and your own subject position has to be something that you really formulate for yourself before you go wading out into these institutions where you might be put into positions where you're asked to do something that you're, you know, that goes against those things. And then thinking about, you know, when do you, the kind of archaeological heritage equivalent is basically, when do you stand in front of the bulldozer and say, I'm not doing that, right? I'm not letting you bulldoze this. I'm not letting you throw away this collection. I'm not letting you take money from this drug dealer, I don't know, whatever kind of things might come up.
Enough about the Zachler Gallery. All right, the final question, and I need to apologise to all four of you because I didn't warn you I was going to ask this one, but what do you think the museum experience is going to be like in 100 years' time? In 2099. One sentence. No pressure. Oh, two if you want.
Can we talk about what we want it to be like?
Yes.
Let's end on an optimistic note. I mean, for me, one of the things that I've been thinking about is I've watched the kind of repatriation discussions and debates chase their tail since the kind of early 2000s, is the idea of maybe replacing the notion of cultural property with more of a relational and kind of reciprocity-oriented way of thinking about what museums have. And so rather than a visit to the museum being about, you know, the collection that they own, the visit to the museum is about the gift exchanging networks, which is very, you know, all the knowledge, sort of Polynesian, Melanesian way of thinking about things that they're plugged into, where actually it's not about holding on to a particular assemblage of stuff that you own, but actually trading stuff in a circle or in a cycle with other institutions in order to really keep things new and keep things kind of moving through a system or a network that you might be a part of. So maybe that's the, you know, in 100 years, maybe we'll get there.
I don't have a sense of what museums, what I would like them to look like or be like, but I hope that they still allow us opportunities for moments of wonder and just being able to appreciate and become excited about human creativity. That's all I would say.
I'll go for very short, open and responsive. And I mean open, hopefully still having the doors open, but, you know, open, being welcoming and being responsive. I have no idea what society is going to look like in 100 years' time. Thank goodness I'm not going to be here. But, you know, I want them to be what society needs them to be at that time.
I mean, hopefully if we're all still here and the earth hasn't imploded or burned away. I think museums will be, I mean, I like the idea of open and responsive, and I like the idea of cyclical kind of reciprocal networks, and I think the idea of networks was something that occurred to me. I think there'll be a lot more, hopefully a lot more exchange between institutions and between communities and countries, and more of a sense of I don't know, community in a larger sense, I hope, is what I'd like to see. But yeah, assuming we're not all burned to a crisp.
Let's end on something slightly more positive. Look, thank you all four of you for your time. I think we've quite easily proved that we could have talked for another hour. So I'll ask you all to pencil in your diary the 18th of May 2022. And we'll find out what the theme is from ICOM next year. But ladies and gentlemen, can you join me in thanking James, Helena, Anna and Alex?
Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chow Chak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, News Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.